Succession number 27747, Reel 5.
Graham Pitt, Reel 5. So.
Well, I mentioned that I had fluffed my board in October or 42. Well, now that we were going into dock, it was an obvious opportunity to have a further selection board. And by this time I'd grown up, and I didn't give a bugger whether I passed or not, because I was perfectly at home in the ship, and I suppose, you know, that may even have stood me in good stead. But anyway, I passed the board without any bother. My friend Fred did as well. So we got a fortnight's leave. And I went back to Chigwell. Then after that, I processed to Chatham again, where the Admiralty Selection Board was being held for the next bunch of... candidates for commission. The Admiralty Selection Board was much more of a hurdle than the ship's board, because obviously they had all sorts of shapes and manner of men coming before them. But on the other hand, a good recommendation from a big ship did count. And I got through all right. And some people were also chosen for cipher duties, and the rest, you know, went back to sea. So I went down then to HMS King Alfred, which you will find still on the front of Brighton as the Corporation Garage. And there they tried to teach me how to be an officer and a gentleman. But we did a certain amount of square bashing. And of course, this was a bit different this time, because one had to take the class, which I found I wasn't very good at that, I must confess. But
you were taking the square mashing class.
Yes. Well, marching them off after divisions and things like that. They were all in line abreast, which is difficult to march in, you know, ten abreast, you know, column of threes, column of fours is all right, but keeping your step right. Anyway, we used to do it quite well, because the pusses were always a bit of a joke amongst the parade ground staff, but they admitted that we were the best to have gone through so far, but they said we got so far no further about halfway through. But I know when I was marching my lot up, I was marching at the front, and the front rank was saying, "Get a move on, and we're overtaking you." Anyway, that was all right. Oh yes, and I did a certain amount of trying to learn to swim, which is not time I did. I suppose we must have... What did we learn? I remember doing cipher work, which came easy to me because I had been partly involved in that in the Sheffield. They trained us on that. They also gave us obscure things like pilotage and navigation, which I looked at with glassy eyes. Anyway, after about 6 weeks, we all got through. I think I passed out 9th out of 48. We went before some board or other, and they said, asked me if I minded going to sea again. I said, no, I didn't. They said, would you like to go out east? I said, no, my quarrel was with the Germans. I'd like to be in the home fleet, please. Which, of course, meant I got a draft to the Far East. So there we were. Yes, I think we went on leave from there. And then, at the beginning of July...
So you had two leaves quite close together.
Yes.
And nothing for many months before that.
Exactly. Then I went back to Chigwell and got a draft to the Ceylon, which was a brand new cruiser, commissioning at Alexander Stevens Yard on the Clyde for a change. So I went up there, very shy. I was the temporary acting paymaster sub-lieutenant RMVR, which is the lowest form of animal life other than a midshipman. And my experiences on that will be found in Warship World, Warship World, November 2004, page 23, which is called The Early Days of HMS Ceylon. Anyway, I was involved in cash duties and that sort of thing, and when the captain's secretary went on leave, I was able to substitute for him, but that was a bit deadly because they were renewing the rivets in the deck above, and but when they were hammering away while I was trying to work underneath, that was quite a hideous experience. I had a bit of luck there with my cabin, although I didn't understand it at the time. All the posh cabins were under the quarter deck, and very nice and snug, whereas I was up in the bridge superstructure with a cabin for two. And this was a bit of a sweat, and definitely sort of low class.
Still with a hammock?
Oh no, bunks, yes, sorry. And but when we got out into the tropics, the sun beat down pitilessly on the posh cabins aft, but it didn't beat down on mine, so I was able to lie on my bunk on a rush mat, nice, comfortable, although the other poor bugger had to have camp beds on the quarter deck, you know. I don't know what they did at sea, I didn't inquire, but there we were. Now, what else happened? Yes, I remember going down the Clyde when the time came for us to put to sea for trials and so on, and it was a great sight seeing all the ships under construction on both sides of the river, including the battleship Vanguard, which looked pretty good. And I think we anchored at Tail of the Bank, which is a anchorage place just off Gourock. I forget whether it was on that occasion or when we were there in the Sheffield, but there was the wreck of a French destroyer there, the Valle Brese. Something had gone wrong with her, I think, and a torpedo had sort of blown up, and the wreck was still there. That wasn't very nice at all. When we were ready for sea, we proceeded to the Isle of Arran, and I remember walking up some mountain there. Goatfell, that's right, from Brodick. Then we went towards Devonport, and I remember taking the cipher log up to the bridge just as we were going round Land's End. So I've seen Land's End from the sea, and that was I've always remembered that. And we put into a Devonport dockyard, where we were fitted with a lot more anti-aircraft guns. I suppose the Stevens would have fitted us out in accordance with the letter of the contract. But the way the war was going, the air power had to be contested in every possible way, so we needed more close-range armament. The captain told us we were to have 36 20mm Oerlikons fitted, but I've never been able to check on whether that number was fitted. Now, you'll say you were only in the ship for 9 months, Pitt, why didn't you check? Why should I? But I didn't. But something flashed into my mind then. What was it? Oh, yes, that's right. I've said that the Stevens fitted it out according to the letter of the contract, but the drill was that if you wanted one or two nice extras, you located the foreman who would be wearing a bowler hat, and you would take him into the wardroom for a glass of gin and say it would be very nice if, and if you were lucky, that was done. So that was the, you know, that was how one bent the rules. Anyway, the time came for us to shove off, and we sailed for the Far East on the 30th of October. And I remember seeing Plymouth dip below the horizon. By this time I was a fully fledged cipher officer, and we'd only been at sea about 24 hours when I got a message addressed to the ship called Operation Stone Wall. So I said, And this was trying to intercept a number of blockade runners which were coming from Japan loaded with rubber and useful things like that. So I got very excited and told the cipher office messenger to shake the captain, the commander, the commandery and the paymaster commander, you know. But it came at night, of course. But I think they'd probably been tipped off, alas, before the ship sailed. But anyway, this confirmed it. So we stooged up and down the Bay of Biscay for a few days. I think we intercepted one Spanish merchantman, which I suppose was harmless. I seem to remember that I was supposed to assist the boarding officer, but what I would be looking for if I boarded, I had no clue. I do know that I went onto the bridge, presumably with a cipher log, when we were near this Spanish merchantman. In retrospect, I think we were taking a bit of a risk, because the Sydney, wasn't it, was sunk by a blockade runner or a German armed merchant cruiser, because she got too close. You know, they've only got to drop the traps and the guns start firing. Possibly we made a ball there, I don't know. But anyway, we went to Gibraltar to refuel and then out again to renew the patrol, but we had no joy. So we ended, we went back to Gibraltar. I think some of the ships were intercepted, but certainly the Germans sent out at least three destroyers or torpedo boats to try and escort them in, and they were caught by the Glasgow and the Enterprise, who had a field day and did rather well and beat them up. Well, having refuelled at Gibraltar, we sailed through the Mediterranean, and this was another balls up. The route through the Mediterranean in those days was specified by points on a chart. So, you know, we were routed from Gibraltar through various points on the charts to somewhere just, I think, south of Sicily. And then an address message came in giving the route from where we were then to Alexandria. The cipher officer, dare we say it, a cleric, made a mess of it and put the wrong number down. Instead of such, let's say the number should have been 243, he put down 234. Result was we made a detour to the south through waters which hadn't been swept for miles.
This was the cipher officer was you?
Oh no, certainly not. No, that was the cleric, the clergyman.
Oh, I see. Sorry, because you said that you. Oh no, you were saying you were not ciphering. You said you were working on signals, and I wanted to go back to that.
Well, I was a cipher officer, yes. But not this. Well, you see, you have to, the cipher office is continually manned 24 hours a day, and you work a watchkeeping system, so you're on watch, say, 1 in 4. Well,
That's what I wanted to get back to. If you could explain what the duties of the cipher officers was.
Well, messages come in cipher, which is a lot of, I think I can say safely, there's a lot of numbers, and you have to translate them into plain language. And what he did was...
So you were a team of cipher officers?
Well, we were only...
Working round the clock?
Yes, but only one on duty at a time.
That's what I meant.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes. Though you had a rating to assist you. All clear so far?
Yes.
Yes. So, let's pretend, say, I would do the middle watch, which would be from midnight to 4, Castel 4 to 8, Bertie Tower from 8 to 12:30, Toothy, the dentist, no, not far actually, where'd I got to? 12:30 to 4, then someone would do the first dog, which is 4 to 6. The dog watches were split up so that you never did the same watch twice,
right.
Which meant that every third night you got a night in, roughly, you know, from midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning. But I found the middle was a bit tiresome, but there we are.
So this particular cipher officer, it was not you?
No.
Had got it wrong.
You got it wrong.
But you weren't mined.
No.
Well,
no, but it could, you know, that's something that could have gone wrong, but it didn't. But after that debark, the cipher watch system was changed and it became all accountant officers. After that, we didn't have any clerics or doctors or anything doing it.
Right, but when you were, presumably you were trained for this,
yes.
But you didn't actually go into that in your training. Where was that at Devonport you were trained?
No, trained at, I did part of it sitting by Nelly, if you like, in the Sheffield,
yes.
On the rating side of it.
Yes.
I had a pretty good idea of what the others were up to.
Oh, right.
And then they did the officer side of it at King Alfred at Brighton.
Oh, right, I see, Yes.
Again I went onto the bridge and I remember seeing puffs of smoke in the air on the port side, and I gather that was sort of a convoy being attacked, but we got through all right.
Mm.
Well, then we got in at Alexandria, went through the Suez Canal, and that was quite interesting because by that time the Italians had surrendered and their battle fleet was moored in a lake in the middle of the Suez Canal, so we had a good look at them as we passed. Then we went down the Red Sea, and this is noteworthy because it was the only time I ever heard the pipe hands to ocean stations, which I think must have been very good for the upper deck people because I should think, you know, they were pretty thin on the ground and could all put their feet up. We put in at Aden, and then went to Bombay. Bombay round to Trincomalee, I think, which was the fleet base on the east coast of Ceylon.
How long were you in Bombay for?
Not very long. Trincomalee was rather sweet then. It was the ideal naval base, according to their lordships, is to have a featureless stretch of water surrounded by sweet F.A. But Trincomalee actually had trees and palm trees and all sorts of things. Of course, I think it's been pretty flattened by the tsunami, unfortunately. But it was quite a nice place. And when we first got there, we could swim over the side. I don't know that I did, but it could be done. But, you know, the water was pure. But as the fleet grew, the discharges were almost anything. made the water filthy, and you just couldn't swim there, swim in the base itself. I think when we got there, there were only a few cruisers there, and it's perfectly obvious that we couldn't attack the Japanese on the coast of Malaysia. But even so, we had moved across to Ceylon from East Africa. The fleet base for a long time, when the Eastern Fleet was in extremis, had been at Kilindini or Mombasa. So the fact that we had moved a number of ships to Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, indicated that we were beginning to exercise our power of command of the sea again.
Mm-hmm. So you were accompanying those ships, were you?
Well, we were just among them. Mm-hmm. Then the commander-in-chief came aboard, and we performed various evolutions. I say we, the upper deck did, I didn't. And everything, it was one of the days when everything went according to plan. And he thought we were the bee's knees, so we cleared our upper deck when he wanted to address us, and he told us the Japs were even worse than the Germans, which I quite agree with. So because of that, we were allowed a little run down to Australia. So we went to the secret base, which is called Port T, but now known as Addu Atoll, at the southern tip of the Maldives. And there, I think we refueled and picked up an American trooper, the Mariposa, and escorted her down to Fremantle. And that's one of the things one doesn't appreciate from the map, the vast distances. Mm. I think it was about 10 days steaming at 14 knots, you know, probably more. In fact, we arrived at Fremantle with rather less fuel in our tanks and was comfortable. But anyway, we got there. But off Fremantle, there was a thing which happened which could have caused embarrassment in general, to me in particular. It, as you know, blue on blue is always a bad thing. And about a few hours before we arrived at Fremantle, I had a night watch, I think, and I had two messages brought in to me in the cipher office. One was a long one and one was a short one. Mm. And normally, the sparkers give you an idea of to whom the messages are addressed. But there was no addressee on the message pad. And there was also no priority. Signals used to have a priority. There's immediate, which takes There's the ordinary one, then there's important, then there's immediate, and then there's most immediate. If it's most immediate, you drop everything, so you invoke the deity and get on with it. But there was no priority on any of the either message. So I thought I'd do the long one first, because, you know, possibly it had some meat to it. Oh, dear. And I suppose this took me the best part of 3/4 of an hour. And then I started on the short one. Bless my soul, it was addressed to HMS Ceylon. In other words, an address message without any priority at all. And, of course, I did that straight away. And it said that two American submarines were exercising off Fremantle. Well, now, the danger was, you see, that if that had been picked up on our Aztec, and we were thought that they were Japanese, and we had dropped discharges on them, and if we had hit them, which is most unlikely now in Ceylon, what then? But anyway, the message was rushed round to those that had to see it.
Yes.
But, you know, it was just one of those things. There was no priority, no indication that it was urgent or addressed to us in particular. So the way these
the second one you looked at,
yes,
and not the last one.
Yes, yes. Whether the hour would make much difference, who can tell? But you know, on that's the sort of, you know, administrative grit that can cause things to go wrong. Yeah. Anyway, we had a very good time in Fremantle. There was a pub just near the quayside, and if you can imagine a pub in Dallas, you know, with a veranda outside, and a first floor veranda, and poles up the front, and swing doors, you know, the first time we saw this, I expected shots to ring out and people to to measure their length on the veranda.
So did you have a good time in Fremantle?
Yes, very pleasant. The local beer was called Swan, and it came in something that they called a schooner, which must have been some sort of measure. And I remember it was just nice to be among white people, to tell you the truth, and also to see white women. Not that I did anything about it, but anyway, I was beginning to get interested then with Mary. But
were you corresponding?
Oh, yes. And we did go up the coast to a nice beach, and I remember that the engine was had a cowcatcher on it. Yes. Fremantle and Perth were, you know, pretty country hick towns in those days, but now I believe they have skyscrapers and all the rest of it.
Yes.
So there we were. And anyway, on the way back, we were told by the captain that when we got to Trinco, we'd find that a battle fleet had arrived there, which was nice. So that was the Renown, the was Queen Elizabeth the Valiant, and the aircraft carrier Illustrious. So we were then able to do something, though it took us a long time to get our fingers out. And the first thing to do was to raid Sabang, which I think now is called Banda Aceh, which is exactly where the hot spot of the tsunami. But I don't think we did Sabang much good. there was a superior Japanese fleet at Singapore. We were under the command of Admiral Somerville, who was a fighting admiral. He had Force H in the Western Mediterranean for some time, and we had confidence in him. He said his plan was he hoped that we would catch the Japanese with their kimonos up. But if the worst came to the worst, he proposed to retire under cover of night with the support of air attacks. So there we were. But that again went off quietly. The next thing we did was to... Yes, the fleet was... strengthened by the addition of an American aircraft carrier, the Saratoga, and that was comforting to have, because the Yanks were pretty good at operating aircraft carriers. But we went to the next trip was to a place called Exmouth Gulf, which is on the northwest coast of Australia, and that again qualifies as a naval base of the most desirable description, being, of course, you will gather, sheet of water surrounded by fuck all. And there we refueled. Oh, yes, so there we also were moored near the French battleship Richelieu, which we had sort of acquired in the course of Operation Torch. But, I was a bit sardonic about the French Navy, I'm afraid. They have little clerks up on their quarterdeck saying honour and patry, you know, they need it. And the captain visited the captain of the Richelieu and said he had face powder on his dressing table.
He had?
Face powder.
Oh. So there was nothing at this port at all?
No
bars, nothing?
No.
No bars.
Oh, no, nothing. We didn't go ashore there.
Okay.
Then we acted as support for the carriers when they raided Surabaya and tried to take out the oil fields.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was moderately successful.